You're listening to DottoTech, helping you get the most out of your technology wherever you use it, at home, at school, or at work. Brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. 20 years, the trusted voice of technology in Canada, Steve Dotto.
Hello and welcome to DottoTech. I am Steve Dotto and I am glad you're joining us. This, the 75th installment of DottoTech. That's an exciting day, I think. 75.
Three quarters to a century.
To 100, yeah. Other than that, it means absolutely nothing. But it's nice.
Unless 75 is your favorite number.
That voice you hear is Art Factora, my producer. And 75. It's just a number. Also sitting in, definitely not just a number, Paul DeMera. How are you doing, Paul?
Awesome.
Good. We've got a great show lined up today. Paul and I are going to talk iPhone because we can't get away from talking iPhone right now because iPhone is what everybody's thinking about right now. But then the rest of the show, we're going to be doing a lot of on the Social Media Week in Vancouver, which is this week. Very exciting going on. We got Shane Gibson joining us. He's hosting the Dragon's Den on Friday. There's going to be three companies pitching their products to the dragons. So it's going to be like a mini Dragon's Den. They're going to be streaming it online. We've got Todd Maffin. There's a hackathon this weekend. I just love talking to guys so Rob Miller is going to be joining us. He's running the hackathon, and we, of course, have Julian Saunders on. We're going to be talking about running Windows on your Mac today.
Could you, in like a sentence, explain, like, after 75 shows, I still have no idea what a hackathon is.
Yeah, I thought I did, and I was right. A hackathon is, although it's more themed than I thought, a hackathon is essentially a group of developers get together and they work on projects that are, over 12 hours or 24 hours or however the length of the hackathon, is they put together an app. They basically build an app. And so designers get together so they build little teams at the start, and they basically make a team of, so the term hacker it has become kind of
breaking into the CIA.
But it's basically people who hack together code. And these folks here all are focusing on green hacking, something that has an environmental impact to a certain extent.
They need to relaunch and remarket the word hack.
Yeah.
I think
by doing events like these, and this is not the only one, there's hackathons that go on all over the world now. And there's also hacker conferences, which are a lot more on, you know, getting into systems, dealing with security and all those sorts of things. So they've got those that are a little more black hat. And there's also white hat. They got their white hat hackers and the black hat hackers. The black hat's the bad guys. The white hat hackers are the hackers that work for the government and stuff like that. But this is more developers in the term hackathon. Enough on it. Enough.
Build a thought. Build a thought.
Have a listen when I talk to Rob. He explains it all brilliantly. Now, let's talk iPhone 5. It has shipped. And Paul, did you upgrade?
Well, I didn't, but my son did.
Oh, so you've had your hands on it?
Played with it, absolutely. Yeah, it arrived. He's actually out of town for a few days, so it arrived, and I asked him if he minded if I opened the box, because I had to sign for it.
You're kidding. He let you open the box?
He let me open the box.
See, I would not let anybody else open the box.
It's an experience, right? It's Apple. It's an experience.
Yeah.
They don't cheap out on the box, either. I mean, the box is actually really nice.
Well, these things are selling for $900. They're not cheap out on the box.
Yeah, that's, I think, what he paid for his unlocked one, 64 gigs. Super, super amazing piece of hardware. I mean, I was blown away just by the whole fit, finish, feel of the device. It really is a next-gen, you know, piece of technology when you look at it. Obviously, there's incremental upgrades as well, but it feels amazing in your phone because it has this solid metal kind of, I don't know how to describe it, just that real wow factor when you hold on to it.
That's an interesting and kind of disturbing response you get.
But doesn't that feeling go away once you put a cover on it?
I don't know. I haven't put a cover on it yet.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's going to be. And there actually has been some criticism. Apple's apparently not quite got it all figured out in the manufacturing process.
Yeah.
And some of them have been shipping with little nicks on the. It's got a very sharp edge on the bezel, doesn't it?
You know, if you are not careful, you can scratch it. I can see that because I'm used to working with audio stuff, and it's got, you know, aluminum on the front with a coating on it. And if you put it on something that is not completely clean, you run the risk of scratching the back of it if you don't have a case on it. So if you get the black one, it's going to be more noticeable too, because it's silver underneath that black coating, right?
Now you open it up, but you didn't activate it, I guess.
No, I didn't have a nano SIM, and I didn't take the plastic off. I just held it and turned it on, and I only got so far in the activation process as well, because you need to put a SIM in it to kind of tell it how it's supposed to behave, because it's an unlocked version, right? So it doesn't know what it's supposed to be when it grows up without a SIM card in it, and it's a nano SIM now.
So overall, the response has been, I think, quite overwhelming for the, as we speak today, over 5 million have been sold, which analysts are being critical about.
I think they were thinking for a little more, but then, as you were talking earlier, we don't really know exactly how many have been ordered, you know?
Yeah,
so
Apple
there's a little vagueness there, right?
Numbers to us. Yeah. So Apple shipped, and of course, there's lots of disruption going on at Foxconn right now, who is the manufacturer for Apple. That's in the news. They call it a brawl, but it sounded like a riot at one of the factories, and so the Apple supply chain could be at risk, and this is going to be a political challenge for Apple how they deal with it, because Foxconn is enormous, and it's almost Dickinsonian in how they treat their employees. I mean, the conditions are not supposed to be very good, and the wages are not very good, and boy, oh boy, Apple, you know, and this is so we can have cheap iPhones.
Well, then, and they're not that cheap. They're not that cheap. So, yeah, it'll all play out, I'm sure. I mean, the microscope's on these folks for sure.
So the first week, the first people that have them, the reviews are pretty much overwhelmingly positive. People are happy with their iPhone. What features, although except for one feature, and they are being absolutely...
Mapgate.
They are being dragged pillar to post over the maps.
You know, I found an app to actually replace Google Maps. It costs 99 cents, and it does help out because it's Street View, because that's what you lose, right? And some of the Google mapping functions. But this new mapping software they've come up with is nice. It's definitely impressive with the turn-by-turn instructions and everything else. But like anything new, you know, you got to be a little patient. Everybody who puts out software usually doesn't get it perfect the first time, and that's kind of where Apple's at. I think they've tried, but there's a few things they kind of oopsed on, it looks like.
A couple of things, you know, my thoughts on it. And I've upgraded my iPhone to OS 6 myself. But I've got an iPhone 4, and I'm thinking about taking the big step up to the iPhone 5. But so I have even less features on my map than people who have the 4S or the 5. But first of all, Google Maps has not always been, and still isn't, that great an interface. It's just we've learned to use it.
Yes.
So we've gotten comfortable with it. So
exactly.
We've figured out its idiosyncrasies. So we're going from one that we know and everybody's used for so long, and Google Maps has been pretty much the only mapping app that most of us have used for an awfully long time. So change is difficult at the best of times. But also, on the other side of the coin, Apple doesn't have nearly the development community working on their maps. Like, Google has something like 700 people in their maps division. Google's going around now mapping. They've mapped everything so well that they're mapping the inside of malls and the inside of public buildings.
So it just gets better for them. And Apple really isn't there, although it, again, is useful, but it's not as detailed, anywhere near as detailed as what Google's offering. As I said, the program that I use is called Live Street View, and it basically is 99 cents. So it's kind of a hybrid.
It probably accesses Google's Maps.
It does. It's exactly what it does. You know, and hence all those developers who've done some great work. So it is a way around the problem until Google releases an app that you can actually download directly into the iPhone and have back into the Google world that you're used to.
So Apple's gotten some negative response to the fit and finish. A lot of negative response to the maps. What have been the most positive things that you've heard?
I think everybody's really impressed just with the overall experience of using it, quite frankly. You know, it just works really, really well. And
LTE is just blowing people away.
Exactly. That's one of the things that a number of people have talked about, how fast it is when you're on an LTE network. I mean, web pages just load almost instantaneously. Mm-hmm. And we're not used to these speeds. I mean, people like yourself and myself, maybe 5, 10 megabits per second at home. LTE, as I've talked about in the past from the carriers, can deliver, you know, 40, 50 megabits per second on the downlink side. So couple that with the A6 processor that can get it on the screen quickly, and you have a wow factor experience for browsing the net or doing anything to do with, you know, internet access. Same thing with using a FaceTime, you know, the video conference capabilities.
All of a sudden,
it's pretty cool. I've been testing it, and it works really well from, you know, if you have a 4S or a 5 to each other and you're on a 3G or 4G LTE network. It's impressive. It really is.
We're going to take a quick break and return. We're going to be talking to Shane Gibson when we come back.
DottoTech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to DottoTech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Joining me online now is Shane Gibson. Shane is the Chief Social Officer of Sociable. He's the author of several books, including Guerrilla Social Marketing, and he is heavily involved in Social Media Week here in Vancouver. How are you doing, Shane?
Hey, fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad that you're here. Shane, we're going to talk about what you're doing with Social Media Week in a few minutes, but I noticed a series of tweets being exchanged back and forth between you and some of your followers talking about the importance of who handles social media in small and medium businesses. And it really clicked with me because let me ask you if what's happening is what I think is happening. Is we've got a whole bunch of baby boomers that own small businesses, and they're a little bit intimidated and a lot intimidated by social media. So they hire these youngins who seem to understand social media because they live it. So the older folks say to the young folk, here, you handle our social media communications, and they don't realize that they're giving them the key to pretty much all of the communications going out of a company.
Absolutely, and it's an interesting dichotomy. Number one, it came from a journalist who works with the Globe and Mail, Shelley White. Mm-hmm. This kind of spurred out a conversation I had with her, and her article came out today called, Why a 22-year-old Should Be Handling Your Social Media. And what it was really about is, the number of large enterprises, not just small businesses. In fact, large enterprises probably are even bigger offenders who just abdicate all of their online leadership to one person in a cubicle who happens to be typically the most junior person in the company because they're also the most tech savvy.
And they're the youngest.
Now, I also, with a grain of salt, or I should be careful with sort of that title, is I do believe that you should let your 22-year-old handle your social media. But that is after they've gone through in-depth mentoring by senior executives in the company on business acumen, on PR, on business strategies, and they're integrated into all the teams so that they understand the business goals and they understand the business rules, the etiquette, their customers, all of these things. But that's not happening. To a large degree, many of the sort of social media implosions we've seen by even major brands online are the fact that, the keys are just given to someone who's in a cubicle who's really not accountable to anybody other than maybe a quarterly report on what's happening on Twitter and Facebook likes. And they're allowed to run amok the brand. And it's a pretty dangerous situation, I think, both for the employee who is given those reins and also the company.
Are we seeing a shift in what corporate identity should look like? What I mean is, in social media, is it okay for companies to be a little less formal, a little more human, a little more vulnerable?
In fact, it's necessary if you want to be noticed in the social media space to human. And this is a real kind of cliche that's really kind of crept up over the last couple of years, is to humanize your brand. Is that when I interact with a Ford dealer here in Vancouver, let's say. And yes, their major dealership account is tweeting out specials and answering questions, but I want them to have almost a more relaxed human dialogue with me. I want on Twitter or Facebook, I want to know I'm talking to a person. And in fact, if they indicate who it is from the company I'm communicating with, it establishes that sort of one-to-one level of intimacy that consumers are looking for. They're not necessarily looking to be a brand's best friend. They're following you because they want a deal. They're following you because they want more information on your latest product release or whatever else. Or they want to follow you because they want to give you feedback, but they do want it to be a human conversation, not me talking to a brand, not me talking to a Ford Focus. I want to be talking to the people behind the Ford Focus. So in order to really gain that effectiveness, brands need to know how to humanize their voice on the social web.
Which really flies in the face of all the training that all of the senior executives have had, which is, you don't make mistakes. You don't put forward any, there's no humanness to the corporation. We are a machine.
Well, and this is back in the day when you owned your brand and the customer owns your brand now. Because I can take, I'll go back to that Ford truck example. Or let's take Starbucks. I've gone to Starbucks. I've decided their coffee tastes burnt. They do all this great advertising. But I take a picture of the Starbucks coffee with me doing a funny face beside it and I post it to Twitter to 20,000 Twitter followers and I say, this Starbucks coffee tastes burnt. And then four or five people chime in and say, I agree, I prefer blends or I prefer Tim Hortons, whatever it is. And then there's a debate online, then a blogger sees it and they do a post about the whole thing. And next thing you know what, the 100 people or so are having the conversation that was seen by tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, and we branded Starbucks. And so Starbucks can't afford to just create this sort of nice sanitized brand and sit back. They have to get involved in the conversation, which means they have to become human in order to really lead that conversation. And so that's, it's a major shift. It, you know, traditional media still works, but it has to be integrated with social and very conversational marketing, which is really putting the hands, you know, the reins over to a whole mob online, or in a nice way, we call it a crowd.
an organization like Starbucks, it's interesting you bring them up because they, at least to me, seem to do a good job of that level of discourse. How does this, how far upstream can it go? Because I keep thinking there's one enterprise that we have here in North America that can't do this at all, and that's our government. They, you know, they are so sanitized, yet they too need to communicate. Does it, do you think that there's an opportunity for them to become a little more human?
There is an opportunity. And, you know, I remember not this immediate past election, but the one before, my co-author and I gave feedback both to the Green Party and to actually the Liberals on how they could possibly use social media a bit better. But on both fronts, the feedback we got was, you know, they really wanted to, even the Green Party to some degree, were very measured in what they did at that time. And I think that to a large degree, my feeling was, and no one told me this, but government is still very much run by the handlers, by the PR teams, and they're shaping the conversation. And yet, if you look at online sentiment, people want to talk directly to those leaders. And this is why the mayor of Calgary, I mean, a big part of his landslide victory was the fact that he was a relatively unknown, but he was willing to truly talk to the people and still tweets daily. So there's room for that. But boy, you know, if industry is taking a while to adapt, government's going to take three times longer.
And we'll see if we're as accepting of mistakes in that space as we are with our coffee vendor.
And we're not.
I think
you know, I think that's probably right. I would agree. And we all love to hate the politicians to many degrees. And so, yeah, they are putting themselves out in the firing line. And the old thing, you know, in regards to social media to large corporations, I even say, look, you know what, you have to be transparent. It doesn't mean you have to be perfect. And this is where the misstep happens, is that you have to be willing to admit your mistakes. And then this is the challenge, correct them quickly. I think sometimes government has more due process to correct maybe errors involved than, you know, a corporation can just say, you know what, let's stop selling that flooring. Let's bring in a different one and let's refund some money and move on.
Yeah.
I think the government has an interesting position because they aren't as flexible as private enterprise to respond to consumer demands.
Yeah. Now, what about North America versus the rest of the world as far as the adoption of social media within our community? I've certainly get the sense that a lot of us think that we're kind of ahead of the curve, but that's probably not the case, is it?
Well, I mean, if you look at, you know, number one, if you look at the way people have been using cell phones in Japan to network and connect in a really hyper-local way and do everything from purchase products to send money to friends to socially network, we realize that in the mobile game, we've been behind for years. And so, you know, North Americans, with all of our greatest innovations, we're just catching up in many aspects. Now with, you know, the advent of Facebook and Twitter moving globally, you know, we were ahead of the curve in that way. But what's interesting is to watch the adoption. I've spent a fair bit of time in India over the last year in Mumbai, you know, doing seminars and sessions with several organizations around social media. And what's interesting statistically is your average Indian consumer who's active on Facebook or Twitter or commenting on blogs or in China as well is actually more engaged than your North Americans. They're actually more conversational. They interact more around content than we do. And so what's interesting is that, you know, globally, although we're ahead of the game technologically, I think culturally there's many other regions that are actually more social just by their nature. So there's been some amazing growth. India, by the way, by the year 2015 will be the biggest population on Facebook. And so, you know, that will bypass North America soon. So we're seeing a major shift to global use of social. And it's bringing along all kinds of challenges with these countries. I mean, India right now is, for instance, going after Twitter and Facebook because of some of the blasphemous, so to speak, you know, Facebook pages that exist. We call it freedom of speech. They call it blasphemy.
Yes. Yeah.
And so there's some interesting cultural things coming to head as we globalize social.
What it does tell us, though, is that there's lots of room for us to engage that much more. And that's what this week is really all about in Vancouver and in a variety of cities across the globe. It's Social Media Week. You guys are heavily, heavily involved in Social Media Week, and you've got a massive event coming up on Friday.
That's right. So at Socialized, we bring Social Media Week to Vancouver every year. This year, co-hosting it with us is the BCAMA and, of course, sponsored by ING Direct. But we've got a really fun event coming up, and that is we've got Bruce Croxon and Jim Treleving coming in from CBC Dragon's Den, and Molly Dugnan, who's actually the producer, will be hosting a panel where Bruce, Jim Treleving, and, of course, our own Danny Robinson here from Vancouver, who's the co-founder of Perch, will be on a panel. And we put together an online contest where you submit your video, and you get to come in and actually pitch the Dragon's Your Business idea very much Dragon's Den style. It's being live streamed to the internet by M2O Media. And the winner of the pitch contest, and it's down to three people now, that winner will get guaranteed VIP front of the line to the actual auditions for the Dragon's Den. But in addition to that, there's nothing saying they might not get an opportunity to actually connect personally with any of these dragons and do business with them. So it's been a while coming. It's going to be at CBC in Studio 40. We've got at least 250 people in attendance. And we've also got a couple keynotes from the dragons. So it's not just a panel, but it's a bit of a learning session, Q&A, plus the pitches, and then a book signing for Jim Treleving's latest book called Decisions. And so, and Jim, of course, is, you know, a local success story, being a West Coast guy, Western Canadian guy, co-founder of Boston Pizza.
Now, the event itself at CBC has been sold out for quite some time, but you are streaming it live. You said, where do we go to find that feed?
Yeah, the best place to go is just to socialmediaweek.org/Vancouver. And on the top post for the blog there, we'll have a link directly to the live feed, and or it'll be embedded right there. And it's also right where you can go to find out about all the other Social Media Week events. We also have a Social CEO Summit just before that as well you can register for.
There's events all Thursday and Friday. I need to thank Shane Gibson very much. He's the Chief Social Officer of Sociable. And good luck with the Dragon's Den. I hope it's a big success.
Hey, thank you very much.
As we've mentioned, this is Social Media Week here in Vancouver. And one of the sessions that they have planned for tomorrow is Old Media versus New Media, Journalism in 2012. And my next guest is a panelist on that panel. Now, I did ask the organizers whether Gillian Shaw from the Vancouver Sun represents old media or new media, and they said you really cross over into both areas.
Well, that's great to hear, Steve, because I just don't like that old media label. For a lot of reasons, but mostly, you know, traditional media. There is traditional media, and that's, of course, as you know, where I had my start at a time when, you know, what we were doing is writing stories that landed on people's doorsteps first thing in the morning in a print edition. And that was pretty much it. But that changed a long time ago for me and a lot of other journalists who had their start in print. So I would say from what I do now, Steve, probably it's now skewing over to that I'm doing more online and more mm-hmm. digital media than I'm actually writing in print. So for every, like, for instance, today as an example, I'm writing a story that's going in print, but I'll be writing, it will be going in print, it'll be going online. It is in addition to writing a couple of blog posts, in addition to creating a video that I'll be also posting online. So when you add that all up, Steve, yeah, a lot of my life is digital.
When you think about your work, when you go into working on any story, what is your first thought of delivery? I mean, because when I used to do my TV show, when I was preparing, I was always thinking about what is this story going to look like when I put it on the air, when I put it on TV. And now the first thing I think is, how can I use this? How many times can I repurpose it? Can I use it as a video cast like we're doing right now? Can I use it on the radio show? Should I be writing about it? You know, what sites are going to want it to be posted on? So I'm thinking about my content as far as always with reflected in how I'm going to deliver it. When you think of a story, when you hear something interesting, what does your mind first go to? Does your mind first go to online delivery, or does it still go to print delivery?
I think my mind first goes to what I can do with it online, because you can do so much more. I mean, for example, the story I'm working on today is about an interactive digital exhibit up at UBC. Well, that it's hard to be very interactive in print. So I'm going to write a story, and I'll use words to describe it and to tell the story of this great Vancouver company. And we'll have a photo, but that's what we can do with print. But once I go online, then I can actually walk people through. This is what it looks like. This is what it was like. You know, this is the technology. Here's behind the scenes. We can, you know, I crawl in behind a screen to see the cameras, and
you'll just use your iPhone.
Carrying around my iPhone, yeah. I can bring that all to our readers and our viewers.
And what about the professionalism? And I don't mean that this from a negative sense, but like when you learned to write, you guys had editor. How many editors would read all of your stories? I mean, everything had to be just so in the newspaper, right? It had to be beyond reproach. But you're in a much more messy environment when you're just sitting there shooting a video and kind of talking along and putting up these organic videos. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm a little bit divided. Readers and viewers on, you know, the people who follow my Digital Life blog are, I have to say, thankfully, very forgiving. And, you know, they realize that I'm not a TV producer. Mm-hmm. And I just take along what I do with my videos. I just take my iPhone. And, I mean, sometimes I'll shoot with a proper camera. But, you know, often I'll just use my iPhone as it's kind of recording the interview for me. But instead of just recording it on tape the way I used to do, or just for audio, now I'll record it on video. And then I may just share some of that. So it's kind of like inviting the viewer and the reader into the interview with me. And rough around the edges, and my video editing skills, you know, are always a work in progress, Steve. But that's only for me. That's me as a content producer and as a writer. Overall, for our business and the media, we're now a multimedia business. We're not just a newspaper business. I think that we do have to up our game, and we are, because if you go on the Vancouver Sun website, we have video experts who are our photographers and videographers who take TV quality video and, you know, do the television quality editing and post it on our website. So certainly for our, you know, sort of the videos where it's a more formal approach to telling the story, you do get that quality. And I think it's important. And I think that we as in the media business have to be striving to do more of that all the time.
You can, of course, find Gillian Shaw at VancouverSun.com. And if you are visiting downtown tomorrow at Social Media Week, her presentation is from 2 to 4 p.m., and you can find information on that at socialmediaweek.org. Gillian, thanks so much for your time.
Great talking to you.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. Do you have a comment or question for Dottotech? Visit our website at dottotech.com and click on Contact Us. Dottotech is brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. Now, back to Steve.
Joining me online, Todd Maffin of toddmaffin.com. How is Todd doing?
Really well, a little under-caffeinated, but we'll
under-caffeinated? Well, you're working at a home office. How can it be?
It's because I switched to decaf. I do this to myself at least twice a year. I know. I don't know why. I just feel like I'll get things done better. And then
how long does that last? And how long does that last?
2.5 days. And then I just crawl back to Starbucks like a pathetic.
So you've had 2.5 days of misery and unproductivity.
Yep.
Oh, and you do it every year. What is the definition of insanity is when we do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results?
That's right. Exactly. That's me.
So I make a post this week. I get a little chuffed because I'm on Facebook and I see a Clearly Contacts coupon in my Facebook feed. Now, Clearly Contacts was giving away a free pair of frames, and I need a new pair of glasses for a show that I'm doing, a theatrical event where I need a pair of little wire frame glasses. So I thought, bonus, I'll get a pair of free frames from the good folks at Clearly Contacts. I click on the link to download it. Next thing I know, my face, my mug, is on everybody's feed saying, Steve Dotto downloaded this coupon. And I'm going, I didn't agree to that because I know I set in my Facebook privacy settings not to be engaged in any of these advertising things. And so I post on Twitter, is anybody else upset about that? And you and several others immediately post back saying, duh, what do you expect? That's the way it works. And there was some bizarre workaround that you had. Explain this to me. I thought that we could stop that from happening.
You can and you can't. You can prevent things for that you post on your timeline, which used to be called the wall. You can prevent those from being shown publicly. You can even per post restrict what you do. So if you upload a photograph, you can say, I mean, you can even say, I only want these three people to see it.
Yes.
No one else gets to see it. Or I want this group of people. Or I want everyone to see it except my mother. Who I do that all the time, I'm afraid.
You can actually exclude mom?
So you've got lots of settings around the content that you post. But this is something different, right? This is content that Clearly Contacts or whatever the company is. They've made that decision. They've created that app. So whenever you engage with that, it's not your privacy settings, it's their privacy settings. And apps are designed, and this is part of the reason why Facebook became so popular, especially among brands, is that you can design these apps. And a coupon is just an app, right? This electronic mm-hmm. coupon that Facebook has is just sort of a little application program that brands, companies can use to build more revenue. So they get this app, and part of the reason that they're so powerful is that they have this feature exactly what you ran into, which is as soon as someone engages with it, comments on it, redeems it if it's a coupon, it gives that person who redeemed it a chance to post it on their wall to all of their friends. What happened with you was that you missed, and it's very brief, and I don't blame you because I miss it all the time, just before you get to that screen where it says, okay, here's your coupon code, or whatever the app is. Sometimes it's, okay, we're about to play the game, or, okay, I'm about to let you read the article, right? Any time that there's that kind of preceding, before you get to what you're after screen, you'll actually notice the screen says, who would you like this information distributed to? And by default, it's going to say friends. Mm. And what that means is all of my Facebook friends. So whether it's redeeming a coupon or whether it's reading an article from The Guardian or yes. any of these things that have this function, by default, it will post that to all of your friends. In other words, it'll post it on your timeline and then be visible on the news feeds of your friends.
Now,
but there's a way around it.
Okay, tell me the way around it first, and then I want to circle back to it a bit.
Yeah, for sure. The way around it is on that screen where it says we're going to distribute that to your friends. If you actually look, that's a pull-down menu, and you can change it to anything. You can say public. And then they don't even have to be your friend to see what you redeemed. But what you should be doing, if you don't want to spam your friends with this thing, yeah. is just change that to only me. And there's no way to say none. There's no way to say, I want to redeem this coupon and have no source, no trace of it. It's still going to be visible, but you can say, the only person who I want to be able to see it on my timeline is me, and then you prevent it from spamming your friends.
That's interesting, because we've all seen occasional posts. Usually it's a scantily clad woman with somebody yes. clicked on to take a look and to read the article, and it's kind of embarrassing, actually. So, yeah. And I've never actually fallen for that in the past. This is the first time that I've fallen for it, because I won't play Facebook games, because when they do tell me they want me to share with others in order to allow me to play, I go, no, I'm not going to tell people that I'm wasting my time. So I don't. So it ends up being a great filter stopping me from doing it. But here's where my confusion was. See, this is an app, and Facebook has apps, and they have ads. I was thinking that I was protected because in my Facebook ads, if I go into my account settings under Facebook ads, I've told Facebook that it cannot share my information with third parties if in an advertising nature, which is what they were trying to do, where if you like a company, it would say, Todd Maffin likes Ford, right? And, yes. and that sort of thing would come up if you didn't give permission. And people's faces were popping up on companies. And sometimes, you know, you might just click like a company so that you can follow it to see what their news are. You don't really like it.
Yeah.
You just want to follow it. So I thought I was protected through that. But you're telling me this is a completely separate stream in Facebook.
It's a completely different thing that you're talking about. Yeah. So what you're talking about are the ads that appear on Facebook. usually on Facebook, on the news feed, on the sides of pages, and they're the ones that look like ads. You know, at the top it says sponsored, and then they're you know, they've got a headline, they've got a graphic, and the one right now that I'm looking at says small business owners advertise your business on mobile, so they look like ads. Those are the ones. What you said is that for when you put that privacy setting in place with Facebook, you say I don't want anyone to know through these ads that I use that. So let's say that you and I both like Pepsi. And like, in other words, we both clicked like on the Pepsi page, right? In other words, and so we've told Facebook that. If you have not put that privacy setting in place, I might run across an ad for Pepsi that says, Steve Dotto, your friend, also likes Pepsi. So what you've done is you've told Facebook, don't put my face and my name beside any ad. So that's that one thing. That's advertisements. What you're talking about is a coupon. These don't appear as advertisements. They appear in the news feed. They show up kind of like content. They show up just like someone's status update saying they just got pregnant or someone, you know, that's where people focus a lot of attention on. So they're two different things.
Yeah. And I know why I missed it, because I didn't actually download that coupon at my computer. I was on my iPhone. And I was probably just trying to get through the screens because I find, you know, browsing the internet on the iPhone less than optimal compared to, you know, my iPad or something else. So that's probably how I ended up missing it. Well, I'm glad you cleared that up. I'm not really happy. But you know, my anger and ire at Facebook is not alone, because they're constantly these days falling under scrutiny. The latest fiasco seems to be them posting old private postings in people's timelines that they had forgotten about, basically.
Yeah, this broke last Monday. It was very interesting. France, it started in France. Facebook rolls out new versions of their site all the time, sometimes up to 13, 14 times a week. So, you know, people always say, Facebook's always changing. It changes once a week. Actually, it changes about 10 or 14 times a week, but just very subtle incremental changes that most of the time we don't notice. And they rolled one of these changes out, and they start in Europe, and it rolls across. And so we started getting, in the middle of the night, we started getting all this rumor and horrible talk from Europe saying, good grief, all of my private messages are suddenly on my timeline and everyone can see. And indeed, when you went to your timeline, it showed what Facebook does on the timeline is it summarizes the stuff that happens every year. This was the big change between the wall, which we all used to have, and some people still do, and timeline, which everyone is going to be forced to use if you don't already have it. Is on the right, you can click a year, and it'll sort of summarize what happened in that year. So you can click 2009, and it'll show you at the top of that screen. It'll kind of scroll back down to 2009, and then it'll show you, okay, here were the brands that you liked in 2009, and here are the people who posted on your wall in 2009. Now, why there was this confusion between people who posted on your wall and private messages was that prior to timeline, the way and even, you know, before we had this new messaging system in Facebook, the way people communicated on Facebook was by posting on each other's wall. Yes. Because the messaging system wasn't up to speed the way it was now. The timeline wasn't there, so it wasn't quite as public. So, Steve, you and I had conversations, which were not really private. You know, I wasn't confessing all the skeletons in my closet, but it was clearly a conversation between you and I, right? That wasn't meant for anyone else. Now what Facebook has done is it's exposed these a lot more. So they were always there. You could always go read them, but they were kind of buried. So Facebook kind of put them in their own little box. Well, that freaked out everybody, because remember, these were conversations that even though other people could see them, depending on the privacy settings, they really were only meant for a couple of people. So they weren't truly the private messages in Facebook that we come to know now. They were just these sort of public but not intended to be public sort of messages. So Facebook exposed them, essentially. This is Mark Zuckerberg's doing. Mark Zuckerberg is of the opinion that all information should be public, and so this is part of it. And everyone freaked out, and Facebook had to come back and say, no, we're not exposing any of your private messages. These were posts that you had on your wall to begin with. That said, Steve, a lot of places, a lot of tech news websites, like the one that I go to the most is thenextweb.com to get my tech news. Hundreds of people were posting on that article saying, nah, these were private messages. I guarantee I was giving people my phone number. I wouldn't do that. I actually had earlier in the week on Monday when this story broke, CBC came by to do an interview with me, and the reporter was saying that the person next to her, who sits near her at the CBC, was having an affair with a married man back in 2009.
Oh my.
And they believe that though she believed that those messages were being exposed as well. So, you know, jury might be still out of whether or not they were actually private, but Facebook swears up and down they were always they were there to begin with.
So it might be a worthwhile exercise to scroll back in the Wayback Machine on your timeline and see exactly what posts are visible, and because you can always edit them manually and take them down, right?
You can actually hide them in a big group, so which Facebook doesn't usually let you do. So what you do is you hit every year, so go to 2011. On the right-hand side, just click mm-hmm. that, yeah. and you'll see. It'll be called something like Posts on Wall from Friends or something.
Yeah.
And if you hover over the top right, you'll get a little icon. If you click it, you can say Hide, and that's it. It'll hide it from your timeline. Do that for every year you're fixed.
Okay. Well, that works pretty well. Excellent. Todd Maffin at toddmaffin.com. Where's your next talk, Todd?
My next talk is in Coquitlam to a bunch of realtors. At night, and then I get on a plane and I fly overnight to the Muskokas and I speak to hospital administrators at 8:30 the next morning. So,
I had a week like that about 2 weeks ago. Thanks for spending this time with us today, Todd.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
Have a good one. Joining me online now, Rob Miller. Rob's a lawyer now turned entrepreneur, and he's into the technical side of development. And Rob has been working on an event this weekend in Vancouver called the YVR Clean Web Hackathon. It sounded so darned interesting, I had to invite you on the show, and thanks for coming, Rob.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So tell me, what is a hackathon is basically a whole bunch of programmers get together, and they work together, share ideas together, and try and come up with a product at the end of the some time frame. Am I correct?
Yes. So teams form, and those teams can have you know, developers, but there's also room for entrepreneurs, designers, communicators, essentially a cross-pollination team. And then they create a product which competes against other products that are being developed in the time frame.
And out of these, are there ever any like real ideas that are born out of these hackathons?
Sure. Yeah, we've had tons of success in some of our previous hackathons in New York and San Francisco. One out of New York was Honest Buildings. They now have 70,000 buildings which deliver transparent information throughout the U.S. There's other ones as well. There really is some substance that comes out of these. One that I'd point you to is Cost Button, which shows how – so it's costbutton.com. So it shows how much it will cost to charge a specific electric vehicle under your tariff plan.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So now the clean web designation for this hackathon, does that designate some sort of an environmental responsibility?
Well, we define clean web very broadly, and we try to keep it undefined so that new ideas can pop up. But we generally define it as a scalable app or web service that addresses a resource constraint. Now, resource constraint can be anything from climate to energy to transportation to food. With our sponsorship from the City of Vancouver, Greenest City, we point to their 10 categories of what it is to be a greenest city. And as well, there's other areas that developers can focus on as well.
So it starts on Saturday morning, 8 a.m. sharp is the actual hackathon. They work for 12 hours. And then the next day you award all of the prizes. Who are you inviting out to this event?
Well, we want to get as many developers out as we possibly can. Any developer working on any platform. I've gone around to the Apple guys. We showed up at the Facebook hack last week as well. But we also encourage designers. Certainly, everything comes down to design in the end. And communicators, entrepreneurs, anybody that's interested in this space, sustainability generally, is welcome at our hackathon.
And it also sounds like it's a great networking opportunity for anybody that wants to be engaged in the high-tech community.
No question. There's tons of great companies from Vancouver that'll show up. Pulse Energy will be releasing their API there. The guys at GridBid, which is a solar proliferation app, will be there, and other clean web companies based here in Vancouver as well. And as well, BC Hydro and the Climate Action Secretariat from the province will be there as well, delivering some real substantive data sets and some really cool things to play around with.
So where exactly is it located?
So it's down at the Hive, Vancouver, which is 128 West Hastings Street. And there is a Friday night event as well. So this Friday between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m., we're just going to have some beer, talk about the various different APIs and try to do some team forming. So that we'll be ready to hack 8 a.m. on Saturday.
And what will it cost?
It's $25 for the whole weekend. You know, the prize events, if you don't want to hack, if you're unable to join a team, if you join us on the Sunday at 1 p.m., it's just $15 to show up and see what we've done.
To see all of the demos. Well, good luck. Rob Miller is organizing the event this weekend. It is called the YVR Clean Web Hackathon. For information, yvr.cleanweb.co is the site, and you'll have to touch base with us when you're done and tell us what great ideas came out of Vancouver.
Certainly will, and follow us on Twitter at cleanwebyvr.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to Dottotech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Joining me online now from Saskatoon is Julian Saunders, who's been helping me out from London Drugs. He is a computing expert there at London Drugs. Now, I don't know, actually, Julian, I've never asked you. Are you a Mac guy or a PC guy?
I'm both.
Nah, you can't be.
I have a desktop PC set up with a bunch of stuff on it downstairs, and laptops for my wife and I are Mac.
Okay, so what do you prefer?
I actually like switching because it helps me learn quicker, but I still prefer using a Mac with Parallels on it so I can have Windows inside of my Mac in one computer.
Now, I have set up, back in the day when they first created the dual boot Macs, I went through the whole process of putting Parallels on a Mac on an old 17-inch MacBook, and it was not a horrible experience, but it wasn't a tremendously pleasant experience to have to go through the installation process. But where it bothered me was that Apple tends to not ship their products with really large hard drives. And I ended up running out of disk space because I had such a large partition for Windows and a large partition for Mac. And it was a bit of a pain. But I did appreciate the fact that I could jump back and forth and I could just had one computer that I could run both on. Have they improved things? First of all, in installation. Secondly, how much space they take up?
They have. It depends on which version of Windows you're using, of course, but the footprint of the software itself that you need to actually get Windows running has become smaller every time. The new version 8, it averages about a gig.
Now, we should point out version 8 is not referring to Windows 8, and when you purchase Parallels, you're not purchasing your Windows operating system license. It configures the Mac to run Windows, and then you have to buy your Windows license on top of that. Am I correct?
Correct, yeah. You can also use different distributions of Linux if you need to.
Which would be cool. But Parallels makes it easy. So what's the process? Have you done it now? Have you successfully installed?
Yeah, I've actually used a half dozen times. I was trying to break it for a while. So the basic process is you install Parallels just like you would another program. You can think of it kind of like a bridge that you're going to have between Mac and PC, and there's a big river running through separating the two. So you install Parallels, and it's an empty box, and then you get to choose what kind of Windows goes into that box for you to run. So if you'd like to use Windows XP, if you have to for work, which a lot of people do, then you can easily install that with the built-in assistance that helps you get one of four versions of Windows installed very quickly and easily.
And you're just working from your existing Windows license, I imagine. Now, but of course, a lot of Macs don't have media drives on them now. Is it easy to connect to the internet and to do all this download and to get your version of Windows as a download as opposed to in media?
It is, yeah. They have links through to the Microsoft Developer Network, otherwise known as MSDN. So basically, you can just download the official Microsoft image that doesn't have a license of your needed version of Windows, and then use the license key to put it in there.
And then you can just use whatever license key you have. Very good.
Right, yeah.
Are you finding
I usually install them that way just because they're the more up-to-date versions than the disks that I own. So if you do it that way, you get all of the first round of updates out of the way during the install.
Okay, now the challenge with earlier versions, if I can recall, was basically it came down to the hardware configuration on the Mac, is getting Windows to recognize the particular video card and drivers and to install properly and all of the... because Apple specs out some fairly unique hardware in their builds of their notebooks or in their desktops, which
That's right,
yeah. other Windows manufacturers don't have. They're not the same standard ones, so they aren't. So typically Windows doesn't have, or Microsoft Windows doesn't have all the drivers. So you're sometimes doing a bit of a kludge. Is that still the case?
No, they have a newer feature called Parallels Assistant, and once you're in Windows for the first time, it automatically detects that it's missing drivers, and it downloads a current driver set from the internet and installs everything that's needed to run the hardware on your Mac. So it happens very automatically. It also adds something called a data fork into your Mac. So it sounds a little bit more punishing than it really is, but it allows your Windows install to see your Mac's hard drives.
You also used to have to make a very difficult decision right at the beginning, which I imagine is still there, is you have to partition your hard drive. You have to turn it into two different, basically turn your one physical hard drive into two virtual hard drives, and you can't change that setting once you've done it. So it's so much pressure right at the beginning.
There is two ways to do it now. You do have an option to leave it open for later growth. So you basically can choose what its minimum size is going to be, what you think it should have, and then it can grow that later. But that method is eliminates a couple of the options that you have concerning restarting and things like that. But for most people, it's the right choice because you don't really have to worry. It's called a dynamically changing volume. So it'll just grow itself if it requires it.
And how do people make the decision of the initial size of their volumes? Is that recommended in the Parallels documentation?
It is, but it's a good idea to make a short list of what you're going to use Windows for. So if you're, say, installing an accounting program, then you probably don't need that big of a space. But if you're wanting to use it for a little bit of work and a lot of fun, maybe running Windows games that you can't get for Mac, then you'd want to make it a little larger. So it's a good idea to seek out a little bit of expert advice at your local London Drugs to just make sure you're crossing all your bases of what you'll need to run.
Now, the Mac notebooks are pretty powerful now. How does Windows run on it? Is it like it's on a good Windows notebook?
It is, yeah. You have to choose how much RAM it has. That's the one big deciding factor on performance when you're running two operating systems at the same time. On my Mac laptop, I have 8 gigs of RAM, and on my Windows 7 install, I told it to go ahead and take 4 gigs of it over, and it ran just as good as a PC with 4 gigs of RAM in it. So it'll change a little bit based on the amount of memory it has available to it, but it does run very responsive. I've been very impressed with the new version of Parallels 8 with how quick it is.
Okay, now, so when... That's if you want to have it set up so that you can hot switch between the two operating systems, right?
Right, so you can run it in two modes, too. There's a mode that basically has Windows inside of a box, just like any other program running on your Mac. Mm-hmm. So it'll just be a window into your Windows install, is how I always say it. There's also a mode called Coherence, and that is a invisible Windows install in the background of your Mac. So it hides the Windows start button and the whole window, and when you need to run a Windows program, it just runs side by side with your Mac programs. So there's no switching back and forth or thinking about which operating system you're using. It just runs.
But the penalty you pay at the end of the day is RAM.
That's right, the one thing they can't fix. So especially if you have a Mac with... if you're looking at a Mac to do this on, it's not advised to do it on a Mac with 2 gigs of RAM, like some of the MacBook Airs.
I'm surprised you're happy.
Any with a solid-state drive and 4 gigs, they tend to get away with it quite easily if they have low requirements. But you can always upgrade, too. Most of the Macs, you can upgrade your RAM.
Yeah, I'm surprised you're happy with 8 gigs, because I've got my Mac with, I think, 16 or 12 or 16 gig on my desktop, and I think that's barely enough.
Yeah, I'm only happy with it because that's the maximum amount I can put in.
do you have an option if you want to just to boot in Windows and give all the RAM to Windows, do your work, and then restart the computer as a Mac? And then if you just have to do like certain tasks, is that an option?
That is, yeah, that's built into the Mac, though. That's not part of the Parallels. Okay. That's a feature called Boot Camp that Apple has inside of all of their Macs. So that one is definitely a point of no return choice on your hard drive size. There's no going back once you've told it. You have to actually delete your Windows partition and then go back in. So yeah, you can do it that way. That'll give you 100% system resources.
Okay, so that's Boot Camp. So if and that's built into the Apple operating system, you just have to purchase a copy of Windows, then you install it, but it's I start up in Windows or I start up in Mac.
Right, and you can't switch between the two quickly. You have to wait for a reboot.
Parallels will allow you to do that, but it's going to reduce the amount of RAM you have in either side.
Yes, so if you're doing a more Mac program RAM-intensive application, you can always turn Parallels off and have all your RAM for your Mac.
It's a decision-making process anybody that wants to install Windows on their Mac is going to go through, and as you can tell from our conversation, probably well worth dropping down to London Drugs and having a chat with one of their experts there before you take the plunge. Julian Saunders is one such expert based in Saskatoon. Julian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Just about out of time for this week, but before we go, I want to point people to our website at dottotech.com. There you can enter to win a sling box. Actually, we're giving away two sling boxes.
Nice.
You should enter, Paul. You need more sling boxes.
I need
boxes.
Another one.
How many do you have?
I got two. Yeah. Actually, Art has one. We still got to do dinner, actually, don't we? That's
right. I owe you.
That's right.
This week's video on the website, we've got a brand new video up on how to use Hootsuite, a social media dashboard. This allows you to pull together all of your different social media feeds, your Facebook feed, your LinkedIn, your Twitter feed, and you can manage all of your feeds of all of your accounts and communicate to people more effectively. It's called a social media dashboard, made right here in Vancouver.
Hootsuite. Sounds like a life simplifier to me.
Hootsuite is, you know what? They consider themselves to be kind of an ecosystem of their own. And they're setting themselves up to survive well beyond Twitter or Facebook or any of them, because essentially we want to communicate on all these different social media platforms. But if you have to go to each one individually in
order
to communicate, it is too much work. Hootsuite, a real time saver, and we've got a nice little tutorial there on Dottotech for everybody to go to have a look. So it's well worth visiting the site this week. Not only can you re-listen to this 75th show of our run, you can also enter to win the sling box, and you can learn about using Hootsuite. I think that's just time well spent. Is that all the time we have, Art? Are we out of time?
That's it.
Pretty much it.
Early Christmas.
I got to thank my guests today. I got to thank Paul DeMera for sitting in, filling us in on the iPhone.
You're welcome.
Paul. And my producer, Art Factor. I am Steve Dotto. We will see you next week right here on Dottotech.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.